Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden. And you know what that means. That means that if Mark's in studio, that it must be pretty close time to get started for gardening. So we'd love to have your questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also post your question or comment on our Facebook page, the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, or you can send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
I am stir crazy. I've had my catalogs for the last couple of months. I've been going through and looking at what I want to do. And I didn't have a gigantic garden last year like I usually do. And
Yeah. And
I swear I will never not plant potatoes again after, you know, going into the store. I know they're still pretty inexpensive, but
sure.
It's like, what?
Yeah, it was a good potato year last year, too.
Yeah.
How come you missed out on the potatoes?
I just got way too busy.
Time-wise.
Just time.
So I tried some new ones. I did some different fingerlings we've never done before.
Good,
so I did like rose fin, and it was really interesting. But I dug them up, and there's like all these little finger shoots coming off on the potatoes. My kids are like, "What's wrong with the potatoes, Dad?" It's like, I think they're supposed to look like that.
So how big do they get?
We're doing our potatoes in a different spot. We're kind of using our neighbor's garden because they weren't using it, and so we had that available to us. We're like, oh, let's do it. The soil was a little heavier, as kind of clay, and so our potatoes didn't get as large as they usually do, so they were a little smaller. So they were probably 3 to 4 inches long, but they had a lot of little side finger shoots coming off of them, so it was interesting. They tasted really good, though.
So what would be the first thing that you would do if you have extra ground? For instance, I've got this year, my neighbors on my west, they're not going to grow a garden, and he's already given me permission to use it. And my neighbors on the east are in Lithuania on an LDS mission, and I can plant stuff over there. So I'm thinking lots of vining things that I don't usually grow.
Well, I just started my 6-week class last week, so we did like our first class, and we talked pretty much about prepping your soil and soil and rebuilding soil and starting a new garden and, you know, how to do raised beds and things like that, and fertilizer. So we kind of did, you know, fertilizers in a nutshell and just kind of hit everything they need to know about fertilizers. But soil prep is just so essential. I mean, that's why I start with that in my class, because if your soil's not very good, we can change that over time. It's not an instant fix. It takes multiple years to take a crummy, heavy clay soil and turn it into something really
Which is
good.
Why your neighbors had more heavy soil than what you've got.
Yeah, because we've been working our soil for many years. So, and we can turn their soil into something a little bit lighter and fluffier, and, you know, it's going to hold it holds moisture really well, but when it dries out, it turns into a brick, you know what I mean? So it needs more organic matter. So we're going to, you know, work on it over time. But you can take really good soil and not do anything to it for 4 or 5 years and turn it into poor soil. And so vice versa, we can take really crummy soil and can, over 5 or 6 or 10 years, we can turn it into really nice soil.
Well, I'm really excited because I mentioned this last week, but I've got a cover crop of Austrian pea that I planted last year.
Nice.
And I got it in kind of late, but everything germinated.
That's
so
great.
I thought, okay, it should be coming up underneath.
Yeah. Green manure cover crops like that will add nitrogen back into your soil, but it doesn't add a whole lot of organic matter.
Right.
The organic matter that's in there, and even the nitrogen, kind of depletes out really quick. So it's a good way to build your soil up, but it's not as beneficial as adding other heavier organic matter.
Like all the leaves.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. The green manure is great. It's just not going to add the quantity or the volume of organic matter to your soil that you really need to improve the soil a lot over time.
Well, I figure if I do a little bit of each, so I put the leaves in one section
and I
put this in the other.
So as your spring's an okay time to incorporate organic matter and fertilizer and stuff into your soil. You just can't do as much as you can in the fall. So fall's really prime time for doing it. And the word that has to stand forward in your mind more than any other thing when you're adding to your soil is variety. Variety of different materials is essential. If you put too much of any one thing on there, even if it's a good thing, it can be a very bad thing. 4 inches of composted steer manure, you would think would be a really good thing. But in a 4-inch quantity on a garden, it's going to cause problems, either salts or ureas or, I mean, something is weeds. Yeah, I mean, you name it. There's a lot of different things. Bringing in that much of one particular organic matter is going to cause problems. But if you counter that with maybe an inch of composted steer manure and an inch of leaves and an inch of, you know, grass clippings that got mixed in with the leaves and a little bit of wood shavings and a little bit of sawdust and a little bit of, you know, peat moss and a lot of variety of different things, then no one thing is going to cause problems in your garden because they kind of all balance each other out. What we have found the last 8-10 years is in the spring, I'll have these gardeners come in, and they're like so excited for spring, and the snow's melting, and they're just like, I can hardly wait to get out of my garden. It's like, oh, you know, we feel the same way. And they're like, I put 6 inches of the compost from the landfill on my garden last fall, and I tilled it all in, and I'm going to have the best garden I've ever had. You know, they're just like so excited about it. And I just want to put my arm around them and say, you know, you did a really good thing, you know, trying to add organic matter to your garden, but 6 inches of that is going to suck all the nitrogen out of
your
soil. I was
going to say, did you add nitrogen?
There's nothing left. I mean, because it's all wood-based material. I mean, it's all shredded branches and limbs and bark. I mean, it's so high in carbon that it will deplete all the nitrogen in the soil to decompose it the rest of the way because it's not finished. I mean, there's a lot of work that has to be done still. So by adding a variety of different materials into your garden in the fall, adding some nitrogen, adding some humate, which has the microbes and the microorganisms in there that will decompose all that stuff through the wintertime, then tilling that in, then it's like having a giant compost pile out in your garden. And by spring, it's all decomposed. It's all back in the soil. It's freed up the nutrient. I mean, it increases your moisture retention. It helps with drainage. It helps, I mean, with everything. But if you put 6 inches of compost from the landfill, and I'm not saying the compost from the landfill is bad, I'm just saying large quantities of anything is usually bad.
It would be bad if you put, I've always wanted to put, cover my whole garden in bales of peat moss.
Yeah.
Well, if I didn't do anything once I did that, I mean, yeah, it would be nice and fluffy, but it would completely drain the soil of the nitrogen.
Yeah. And the peat moss is great too for adding organic matter and moisture absorption. But as that peat moss decomposes, there's really not much left. I mean, it just kind of all disappears.
It's gone by the next year.
Yeah, it disappears. So that's why leaves and grass clippings, and I like to suck up my leaves with the lawnmower in the fall, and then it gets a little bit of grass clipping in with it and kind of chops it all up, and that's like perfect. That stuff's great.
So where do you get your grass? I mean, do you have your ready-made business?
Yeah.
Because I've got my grass, and I'm mulching because I want to return those clippings back to the soil, but...
I always bag in the fall. I bag in the fall.
But if you want to use it during the year, I don't even do
that in the middle of the year though.
Okay.
It's mostly in the fall because grass clippings in my garden in the summertime, and this is just kind of a personal thing. It just mats down and just it makes a mess for me. I don't like it. And I'm not saying it's not good for your garden because there's a lot of people that do. They put grass clippings down between the rows and I mean they try and dry the green they make a mess. Once they're dry, they're not so much of a problem. But for me, it just kind of mats everything down. And so I kind of stay away from that. But in the fall, as my leaves are dropping off the trees, I'll mow the lawn, suck up all the leaves, chops up the leaves, throws a little bit of grass clipping into it. That's like perfect for working into the garden in the fall. That's amazing. But straw's great for organic matter. Like I said, the leaves and the grass clippings are great. You can use wood shavings. You can use sawdust. You can use ashes. Just don't use too much because there's a lot of lye in there, so that can cause a problem.
I've heard those are good for potatoes.
The ashes?
Yeah,
as long as you get them spread out. I mean, you don't want an inch of ash out there, but if you do, you know, like a little quarter inch of ash or less and spread that over the whole garden, that's got tons of nutrient in there, so that's really good.
I had someone who saw me spreading all of my leaves, and of course, I went and got the neighbor's leaves and everyone else's leaves.
Yeah.
This was 2 years ago, and then I'm walking around with my hand spreader.
Fertilizing,
They're like, why are you fertilizing your lawn this time of year? Mm. And just going back to what you said, if I don't, then I'm not going to have any nitrogen in the soil, and this will help break down all the leaves.
So all those microbes and microorganisms that do the decomposition of all that organic matter that's out in the garden, they must have nitrogen to complete the process. So if you add a high carbon-based material, and all the carbon-based organic matter is dry and brown, straw, wood shavings, leaves, you know, anything that's dry and brown is super high in carbon. Anything that's kind of green and wet, you know, wet grass clippings and, you know, cuttings off your food scraps and stuff, you know, watermelon rind and you know, that's higher in nitrogen. And so using a blend of those, you're going to have much better results than just using all carbon. If you use a high carbon base, which is really your best organic matter, that's really going to build your soil back up. You've got to add nitrogen to the mix, or else it just gets halfway through the decomposition process and it will just stop, because those microbes and microorganisms need that nitrogen to complete the process.
So if you put a lot of organic matter on the dry brown organic matter in the fall, but didn't put any nitrogen with it, can you replenish it by going through and just broadcasting some nitrogen?
Yeah. It's just, it won't decompose through the winter time. But what will happen is it will have sucked all the nitrogen out of your soil. And so that when you go to plant in the spring, your things will germinate. They'll get up about an inch, maybe 2 inches tall, and they'll just stop growing because there's no nitrogen left available for them to use. It's just all been used up in that decomposition process. So it's so important to get 3 to 4 inches of organic matter on your garden in the fall. Add some humate, which will supplement your microbes and microorganisms. Plus it puts a lot of mineral and micronutrient back into the soil as well too. And then it has fulvic and humic acid in there, which helps decompose the stuff even faster. And then you add the nitrogen to the mix and you till it all in. And in the spring, your soil's just like way improved over what you had the year before.
Have you taken ashes and thrown them out on the snow in like February?
It'll melt the snow.
To get the snow melted.
The humate works great. The soil activator, you can broadcast that out. It's black and it's got the humic and the fulvic acids in it. It'll actually melt your snow right off your garden.
I was thinking probably anything dark, coffee grounds.
Yeah. So it absorbs all the heat from the sun, but it's high in that fulvic and humic acid, and it just melts snow like crazy. Yeah, it's awesome.
I'm hoping that there is that we have a wetter than normal spring, but just enough of a period of a window where I can get in, work the soil, and get my peas in.
That's what we really need. Is we need like 10 to 14 day breaks in between storms where you can actually get the soil dry, get out there and do something, and then, you know, bring the moisture in for another couple of weeks. So if we can get those little cycles of wet periods, you know, 10 days wet, 14 days wet to, you know, 10 to 14 days dry in between, that's like the ultimate spring for us. Is we need that moisture, but we need some time in between all those storms to be able to get something done. So 3 years ago, it was 2011, when it was so wet and you couldn't do anything. Yeah. I mean, you'd go out, you'd dig a hole and it would fill up with water before you could put anything in it. it was that wet. Was that 2011? Maybe it was 2012.
It was like 2 years in a row.
Yeah, it was really wet 2 years in a row. And it was hard to get out and get anything planted. I mean, spring started so late. And then, 2012, spring started really early. So it was like March and April were just gorgeous, beautiful weather. And everybody was out doing stuff super, super early. So, and then last year was kind of wet to start off the year. I mean, we didn't really get much going until May last year.
Well, let's talk about some things to do indoors. So in northern Utah, there's still snow on the ground. Southern Utah, though, the ground is workable, I'm sure, in St. George. Get your peas planted.
Yeah. I've got a lot of people coming in right now looking at seeds, and all of our seeds are really close to being in. And, I've got people already calling from St. George and from Arizona getting their seeds, you know. So we have a great listing online. It's got descriptions of all the seed varieties that we carry, and it's got pricing and everything. And we just drop it in the mail and send it out. So we do quite a bit of online ordering that way. The prices are just amazing.
If you had one pea variety to grow, what would it be?
I still like Green Arrow about as much as anything. Mm-hmm. But if I were to choose one out of all of them, I mean, because we do a lot of Green Arrow, a lot of Victory Freezer, Perfection. They're great for just shelling and eating, and they freeze really well.
Are people just buying it because they've been around for so long and they're just used to getting it?
Most of those varieties have been around for a long time anyway. I mean, all the peas are open pollinated. They've been around for some of them for 50, 60, 70 years. They're just good all around varieties.
Laxton's Progress.
Yeah, Laxton's Progress has been good. But if I were to have to just plant one, it would be Cascadia. The Cascadia is a snap pea, and so you can actually pick it while the pods are flat and use it as a stir fry, you know, flat oriental style pea.
And eat the whole thing.
Or you can let it fill out all the way, and you can still stir fry it and eat the whole pod and everything. Mm. Or you can shell the peas out of it and just eat the peas. So it's kind of a versatile pea variety. And it's really sweet. It's super sweet.
I've yet to find a pea. You still have to grow a ton in order to really freeze any.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had 6 rows, each row 25 feet long.
Yeah.
And we barely got enough because you want to eat them.
Sure.
They're so good.
Yeah.
So
the nice thing about peas is their season's shorter. And so you can plant a whole bunch and they're done by the 1st of July. And then you can recycle that space. You can put something else right back in there and then you can utilize, you know, something else for the rest of the year. So yeah, peas, you got to plant a lot. They're a little bit of work. Yeah, maybe a lot of work. But you can reuse that space when they're done and have something else. I mean, we've taken our peas out the 1st of July, planted bush beans, and had a great crop of bush beans through the fall. We've done corn before. I mean, there's a lot of different things you can reuse that space, so you can actually get 2 crops for one.
What I've discovered over the years, that it's better for me to pay a little bit more looking at how do I keep my peas nice up and straight because they always flop over.
Yeah.
So finally I went and got
start fencing them.
I got pig panels.
Yeah.
And they're like $17 a piece.
Yeah.
But they're going to last
forever. They'll hold
forever.
Up for years. Yeah, and for years and years.
The peas, especially the year I got them in early and the peas were up like 4 feet tall and higher.
That's the only way to go.
I had no problems with flopping. Yeah. So
now this is really interesting. If you look at the days to maturity on your peas, and I've always wondered how this works, we'll have to do a little scientific experimentation. Most of the varieties are about 60 to 65 days to mature. But peas like the cool temperatures, and so the earlier you get them planted, the better that they will do. My grandfather never planted anything in Cache Valley until Memorial Day.
Nothing.
He would wait because it was cold. And
not even peas?
They wouldn't plant anything. So he'd plant his peas towards the end of May. Sometimes it would be like the first part of May. So let's just to make it simple, let's pretend that we can plant peas on the 1st of March, on the 1st of April, and on the 1st of May. All right. They will all produce peas the first week of July.
At the same time.
Whether you plant in March, in April, or in May. That's definitely not 60 days. If you plant them the 1st of May and they produce the 1st of July, that's 60 days. If you plant them the 1st of March and they produce the 1st of July, which they will do, that's 120 days. Mm. So it's all relative to heat. So it's heat units. But the ones that you plant in March will do better than the ones
you're going to get a lot more production off of those.
Much more production. So the ones you plant in May produce in the 60 days like they're supposed to because of the heat. But the ones that you planted in March got established and developed root system and developed, you know, a lot of strength before it turned hot. And then they really won't produce until the temperature of the soil warms up. So
well, the reason I keep hoping there's a thaw in February for the ground to be worked. And I did notice that at least during this little warm-up that we had the last couple of weeks, the area on the south side of my house up against the steps, I was,
maybe
I should put something in here because the ground was workable.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I planted peas in February, it was about the 3rd week of February when I did this 7 or 8 years ago. Best.
Oh, yeah. Ever. Best ones
Absolute
ever.
Best. Yeah. It took 2 weeks for them to germinate.
Oh, yeah. They'll just sit out there forever.
Yeah.
But for early crops, so if you're getting to that point where you've got a cold frame out there or we got rain the last 2 days and more snow has disappeared, I mean, there's a lot of grass showing up in my backyard and I'm just kind of doing a little happy dance out here because that means there's no hard, solid ice underneath. So even if we get a couple good-sized storms and we get 6 or 8 or 10 inches of snow, it's going to melt off quick because it doesn't have that sub-frozen layer underneath. It just like takes forever to melt off. So I'm kind of anticipating early planting this year. So this is a good trend. But early stuff: peas, spinach, lettuce, radishes, onions, cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli. So that whole group.
So would you
turnips?
Would you start cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli outside?
You can start them right outside as soon as your soil is workable. They will germinate at soil temperatures around 40 degrees.
Okay, so it's not like they're going to sit there and I've never planted them outside.
I'll do great. But I've got a lot of people that are starting them indoors right now. So I've got,
because they're easy to transplant.
Yeah, I've got gardeners who are starting onions inside right now and even lettuces to transplant out and cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, because 6 weeks from when you start them, you could basically transplant little plants outside. So that's middle of March. If you start them right now, they're gonna be ready to transplant out middle of March, and you'll have your own seedlings to transplant out if you have room inside. And you don't have to take up a lot of space. I mean, who's gonna grow a full flat of cabbage? I mean, most of the time you only do, you know, maybe 6 or 8 plants at the most. So it's like you can start a few cabbages, a few broccolis, you know, some lettuces and some onions and do them all in just one tray and then transplant those out as the time comes. So.
Well, we've discovered at the Earl House that we like cabbage, but we've just never had room for it before.
Yeah. It does take up a
lot
of space.
And we love the big purple-headed, I can't remember the variety, what they're called, but we love the purple cabbage.
Yeah, I've got Red Acre.
Yeah, which is, it's the Red
Acre. Really
thank
good.
You.
Yeah. There's one that's called Red Rock that's really nice, too.
Does it get bigger? Is it sweeter flavor or something?
About the same. The reds aren't as large as some of your other greens, you know, like Danish ball heads, like basketball size. Yeah, it's massive. So the reds tend to be a little bit smaller. Most of the time you go to the grocery store, you don't see massive heads of red cabbage. They're just, you know, kind of average size. But Red Acre.
But they'll get big if in your own garden.
Yeah, Red Acre. Red
Acre's
really good.
Which ones don't split as much?
Later varieties tend to split less. The most of the early varieties, once they're ready, if you don't pick them when they're ready, they will mature a little bit more, and then they'll split open.
And I can imagine if the ground dries out a little bit, and then you water them, and they swell up with that water.
So I've got an early variety that's called Columbia. That's one of my favorites.
That's
really sweet
one.
And good. It doesn't split as quickly as, like, say, Golden Acre, which is good old-time fashion cabbage. But as soon as it's ready, if you don't pick it, it splits every time. Danish Ballhead doesn't split really much, and Late Flat Dutch is good. But they're later varieties. They take 120 days to mature, so usually it's not until September when they're starting to split. It's been sitting around too long.
Are cabbages biennial?
They are biennial. So if you want to get seed off the cabbage, you really have to let them winter over, and then they'll produce seed the next year.
So will they actually winter over?
Yeah.
Okay.
They will. So that's one of the things. I mean, with heirlooms becoming so popular the last few years, and people wanting to grow and harvest their own seed, and all these seed exchanges and stuff, I have people just coming in and asking questions about this all the time. They just really don't understand how difficult it is and how time-consuming it is to grow your own seed and harvest it. People quit doing it for a reason because it's a pain in the neck.
Especially those finer seeds, when they take
tough.
A couple of
it's
years.
Tough.
I mean, peas I could understand. Well, I mean, that's pretty easy to collect.
Think about great-great-great-grandfather Joe. When he was doing his own seeds, he was lucky to have maybe 10 or 12 varieties in the first place. And we have literally thousands at our fingertips now. And his nearest neighbor was 5 miles down the road, not over the fence on the other side. So when your gardens are close and you've got bee pollinization going on and wind pollinization going on, and you're growing all these different varieties, I don't care if they're heirloom open pollinateds or not, they're going to get pollinated with something else, and they're going to get contaminated, and you're not going to have the same thing. And so it's just not slam dunk easy. I can grow these in my backyard. I'm going to harvest my seeds. I'm going to have my own varieties. You will have your own varieties.
Yeah.
They will be completely different than the ones you grew
and every,
the year before.
Every one you plant, every seed you plant
will be different than the next.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as it looks. And so we'll teach you how to do it if you want to do it, but you have to isolate and you have to protect and you have to prevent cross-pollinization.
Just don't even worry about corn. Don't even try to do that with corn.
It's tough. That's tough. So, it's kind of idealistic. It'd be really fun to be able to do some of these, and some people can do it. But if you don't have the right conditions, realistically, it's very difficult to do.
So. Well, we've reached the halfway of the program. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is my guest. We are taking your questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page or send us your email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll be talking about peanuts and sweet potatoes, so stay tuned. Welcome back to the second half of the program. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and it's the Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio with us. And I've always wanted to grow sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
And so last year, under the direction of my mother, who said that she had, you know, the sweet potato vines that you can get in the stores,
right,
and ornamental.
Right. Yeah.
She said she dumped hers out,
and there was a sweet potato. Yeah.
So I did that, and I'm like, okay, this works, and it was edible, mm-hmm. so why can't I transfer mm-hmm. this to the garden
yeah.
and those, do something with
those
it?
Those usually don't taste very good, though.
I didn't, yeah. yeah. It wasn't very big.
We've eaten them, and they don't, those don't taste very good. But there are varieties that do taste really good that you can grow. So we have done sweet potatoes before. Sweet potatoes are very frost sensitive, so you have to be really careful with
like
them.
Like basil?
Yeah. Even if you say frost in their presence, they turn black and start
growing. So you would not put them out until, at least in Cache Valley, around the 1st of June?
End of May for sure, but you've got to prep your soil in advance because they do not like cold, wet soils either. So what we will usually do is have our customers either do them in raised beds or kind of do a raised soil out in your garden. So kind of furrow and hill the soil up a little bit out in your garden. And then I would put black plastic or weed barrier over it 2 to 3 weeks before you're going to plant. So it can generate some heat and get that soil warmed up before you put those little plants out, because they are really sensitive. Sorry. You can start your own from just a sweet potato that you buy in the grocery store.
Just like regular potatoes.
And just let the little sprouts come up.
Okay.
Because basically, if you were to buy the sprouts, they're called slips. And they're spelled S-L-I-P-S, just like, you know, slips. But they're just sprouts that have come off the potato. And you take those slips and you plant them out in the garden. Usually there's a little bit of green on top so you can see where it's going to grow. And you just plant those. And we're doing them about every 2.5 to 3 feet, you know, one plant every 2.5 to 3 feet.
Because they do
feet.
Kind of vine.
Yeah, they vine out considerably. And you just got to get that soil as warm as possible. I would put those plants out, and I would literally aquadome, wall of water. I mean, hot caps are almost not generating
enough
heat for them. Yeah, I mean, you need something out there that's going to really generate some heat and some frost protection for them. If it even gets close to frost, they are on the ground. I mean, we've had sweet potato vines in our greenhouse, our non-heated greenhouse, in the spring, you know, latter part of April, first part of May, when the temperatures can drop in there down to 40 degrees. And that's what the heater's set to. If it gets to 40, you better kick on. It gets down to 40 in there, and they are like on the concrete the next morning. I mean, they're just like laying down. They do not like it.
Did and they come back?
They come back, but they're really unhappy couple days. Yeah, so you got to be really careful with those. Our growing season is long enough. I mean, so if you get the right varieties, the ones that we've brought in, there's one that's called Georgia Jet that's really good, and I have a source for getting the plants if you would like. I haven't brought them in for a couple of years because the last two times we did it, it was such cold, wet springs that they just, they did awful. They did so awful. Everybody was complaining about it. It's like, I'm sorry, I have no control over the wind, over the weather. You know.
Well,
like,
I guess if worse comes to worse, then you can't ever get them in the ground. You just eat them.
Because I mean, all the rest of the countries, we have to order them early, and then they ship them, and they come in about the first or second week of May, which is too early for us. But if we don't get them then, they're gone by the end of May. So we have to get them in at a certain point. They just didn't do very well. So Georgia Jet's really good. And then the other one is called Beauregard. And I think of the Bugs Bunny cartoon all the time when there's one where he's like a Civil War dressed up and he's like, Beauregard. Do you remember that one? So that's how I remember that variety all
My
the time.
My dad had a dog named Beauregard. Uh-huh, so. Yeah. Okay, so I'll remember that one.
So Beauregard. And those varieties are earlier and they will actually do quite well around here. And so you want to push them as late as you can into the fall, because the longer they sit and grow, the bigger those tubers get. And I would fertilize them pretty consistently throughout the summer.
Would you treat them just like a regular potato?
I would treat them more like a tomato plant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So you're going to go high phosphorus, you know, adequate amount of nitrogen and potassium, and be real consistent with it through the summertime. Either water soluble every week, or, you know, a slow release granulated maybe once when you're planting, and then maybe halfway again through the summer, but I'd still supplement it a little bit with a water soluble fertilizer.
But as far as planting them, do they have eyes like a regular potato?
The slips are going to be they're just going to be little green sprouts. So once you get those planted, they start to vine out all over the place. Then that root system is going to just develop those tubers.
Okay.
Just like the ones you see at the grocery store. You know?
And do you plant the whole thing? Like if you have a sweet potato,
you take the slips off the potato plant just the sprouts.
And plant just the sprouts.
Yeah, plant just the sprouts. So you can do your own that way.
Could you put them in, like, say, a gallon? I've got a whole barn full of.
that's basically what we started recommending to our customers is, you know, the slips come in the first part of May. You need to start them indoors and get them going before you can transplant them out, because otherwise they're going to dry up and they're not going to do very well. So we kept them in the fridge for about a week and they seem to do okay, but then they just start deteriorating after that. So problem with doing your own is you don't know what variety you're buying at the grocery store.
Right.
And so you're probably going to get a variety that's much, much later that was grown in the South, and it's probably not going to do very well.
It'll never get that big.
It's not going to get that big. But I've had a lot of customers in Cache Valley and also over in the, you know, Tremont and Brigham City area that come in our store considerably, you know, a lot, and I get feedback from them, and they've done really well with the sweet potatoes. You just have to really baby them, and then you want to extend that season into the fall as much as possible with a little bit of frost cloth, the freeze proof. I mean, anything you can do to get them past that first little frost so they'll keep producing for another week or two, and then you'll have really pretty good production off of them.
Our Earl family vegetable is the asparagus, but sweet potato is getting up there,
like,
because
I
love sweet potato fries, just baked.
You can get a couple, 3 to 5, 3 to 5 pounds off of one plant if you grow it right. I mean, some of those potatoes are, you know, over a pound a piece if you get 3 to 5 to 6, 8 potatoes on each vine.
So are they more acid loving or neutral?
Kind of 5.5 to 8 on the pH scale is probably fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so we're just fine here.
Yeah, it should work. Should work great.
Well, what about peanuts? That seems like peanuts, that would be even more work.
Peanuts kind of in the same boat. Yeah, I mean, you got to really protect. I've never done peanuts. My dad grew peanuts a long time ago. Yeah, my dad grew peanuts and they did okay. A little bit longer season than the sweet potatoes. Same kind of protection. They really don't like the cold soils in the spring, so you got to get them started indoors and get them going. So you can do it.
It seems like that would be, you're not going to ever get enough to eat a whole ton. And to me, it seems it would be more of an experiment just to see how it
depends on how many gardens you get from your neighbors to work with. So if you've got a big plot,
if you've got a
big plot and you don't know what to put in there, you know, it's like, you know, some things definitely are better returns on investment for the amount of space that you've got. You know, so if your garden's not too big, I mean, you don't want to take up a lot of space with corn and squashes and things. I mean, they can take up a lot of space for not so much return on investment. But if you have a big area, then they're the best. I mean, we grew so much corn last year in our garden that I swear, I mean, we had 20 gallons of corn.
Wow.
That's just what we froze. That doesn't include what we ate and what we gave away. I mean, so it can produce a
lot. And that's usually
lot.
What I cut back on, because the corn takes up so much space. I think that's what I might be planting.
So, I mean, when it comes down to it, if you're kind of worried about space and what you can plant in there, I mean, try and list what you like the most, you know, and go through and kind of rank them. And if you've got space, you know, plant the stuff that you like the most. If you don't have the space, you got to start eliminating some of the ones that aren't as important, or the ones that really take up a lot of space. You know, I've got people coming in saying, okay, my garden's only 10 by 15 and I want to do, you know, 3 pumpkins and 2. And it's like, well, wait a minute.
No.
It's like that's your whole garden right there. You know, just 3 pumpkins are going to take that whole spot.
I wouldn't even grow a zucchini because the plant gets, you know, pretty good size.
Oh, yeah, I get pretty good size. But, I mean, your return on investment on a zucchini is really good, though.
Yes.
You know, so it just, when it comes down to pumpkins, I mean, how many pumpkins do you really eat? And you use them for decor and for things, you know, for Halloween, but I mean, they take up a 15 by 15 spot, one plant. And
there are other squash that are better for eating.
But then you've got people that have a garden that's, you know, 7,000 square feet, and they're trying to find something to cover ground so they don't have to deal with weeds. Oh, yeah, then you throw, you know, a bunch of corn and squashes and stuff in there, and it takes up space, and you have something to eat through the wintertime, and it's awesome. So it's just relative to the amount of space you've got to work with.
Well, we've only got 8 minutes left in the program in this conversation. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden will take your question. Our Facebook page at Utah Public Radio, you can leave a post your comment or question there. ZestyGarden@gmail.com is our email address, or you can call the old-fashioned way, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So what corn would you prepare for this year?
Oh, that's a good question. I've gotten to the point where we only plant one variety now at our house.
And you just do it in succession.
And it's optimum. And I don't even do it in succession. It's just so good.
I just can't
grow anything else. Yeah. It's like you kind of get to the point where if you've been growing NK199 and you like switch to like say Ambrosia, you just can't go back. And because NK was a great variety for years and years and years and years. But I mean, those old sugary corns, I mean, it's just a SU corn. They just don't hold up very well. I mean, you got to get them right at the right time or the sugar starts to convert over to starch. And it I mean, it's an inferior variety. You get to Ambrosia, it's a sugar-enhanced variety. It'll hold its quality for a week or 10 days in the refrigerator.
Gives you time to get things canned.
Yeah, and it's just sweet and sugar, and it's really good. It's hard to go back. You just can't grow NK after you've had Ambrosia. But if you go from Ambrosia and you plant Optimum, which is what I'm growing, it's kind of hard to go back. It's just that much better. It's insane.
So what happens when you go from NK199 to Optimum?
To Optimum, then you just like keel over dead because you're just like, oh my gosh, I didn't know corn could taste like this.
It makes the NK taste like field corn.
Yeah, there's some people that don't like the super sweets though. So Optimum is a super sweet variety. It has some distinct advantages. It will hold its quality even longer than a sugar enhanced. So, I mean, we're talking 2 weeks, sometimes even up to three, especially if it's refrigerated, it will maintain its quality.
This is the Optimum?
The Optimum, yeah. So you can pick it, throw it in the fridge, eat it 2 weeks later, and it tastes as good as the day that you picked it. A couple years ago, we had to go out of town for a wedding, and we were gone for 10 days, and we had picked some corn before we left, and I had frozen some of it. We just didn't have time to deal with it before we had to take off. And so we had about a half a bushel left. We called one of our friends, said, hey, we got a half a bushel. And they're like, is that your special corn? It's like, yes. And they're like, oh, we want that corn, you know? And it's like, okay, I'll put it on the porch. You know, you come pick it up. We're leaving tomorrow morning. You come pick it up sometime tomorrow. It's just sitting on the porch. So we take off. We come back. Guess where the corn still was when we came back? Still sitting on the porch. They'd forgotten to come get it. And so I went to go throw it in the composter. And my wife's just like, let's take a look at it. And I was like, that's not going to be any good. She's like, oh, let's just take a look at it. So we peeled it back. I mean, this is sitting out 95 degree weather. It was in kind of a shady location, but it's still 95 degrees. So the husks are completely dried up. I mean, they look just pathetic. And it's like, that's not going to be any good. She's like, oh, let's just check it. So we pulled it back and looked at it. And the ears looked pretty decent. I was like, yeah, they don't look too bad. She's like, let's try it. Let's just see if it's any good. So we peeled it. I mean, seriously, those husks were just dry. I mean, there was nothing, no moisture left in them. It was just like was ripping paper off of them. And we dropped it in the pot. We cooked it and we ate it and it was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's Optimum.
That's what Optimum is. Yeah. But it's now, really, really sweet. It's so sweet. It's almost like you put sugar on it already. And so some people don't like it because it doesn't have that old fashioned corn flavor. I mean, it tastes like corn. It's got that great flavor, but it's really sweet. I cannot use it in recipes. Like if I've got a recipe taco soup or something, it calls for corn in it. And it's like adding an extra half a cup of sugar to the mix. I mean, it sweetens it up. It can change the flavor of the recipe. So you have to be a little careful with it that way, but it freezes so good.
I mean, so that's where the Ambrosia would come in.
It's like I pulled some Optimum out of the freezer the other day that we froze this July, and honestly, once we thawed it and cooked it, it tasted just like the day that we picked it. Mm. It's just that good.
I used to grow Miracle because I loved how
Miracle's good.
Big,
yeah, yeah. Miracle
those
big ears.
Would
Optimum
get.
Has big ears too, but the cool thing about it is it produces multiple ears per stalk. I mean, up to 5 ears per stalk. I've gotten 4. I've never been able to get 5, but the grower
4 full ears.
4 ears per stalk. You got to fertilize it like crazy. So, but the grower.
So more. So I usually do 3 times.
The grower that we buy it from that developed it said they consistently will get 3 to 5 years per stalk off of it.
So what exactly are they doing to get 3 to 5 years?
Just natural breeding. I mean, there's nothing special
but
about it.
But how often are they fertilizing?
They are fertilizing 3 times a season.
Okay.
So at about 12 inches, at about 36 inches, and about tassel with just straight nitrogen down the rows because that corn will just suck all the nitrogen out of your soil. So, but Optimum... I mean, has some great, great qualities to it. It's a little bit more expensive, but it goes farther for your money. So really, when it comes down to it, you're paying about the same per kernel as you would for Miracle, Incredible, mm-hmm, Ambrosia, mm-hmm, Bodacious, Sugar Buns. I mean, so people kind of freak out when you tell them how much it is per pound, but they don't realize that there's 70% more seed per pound in it than there are in the other varieties because the seeds are really light and small and shrunken. So,
and you don't want to plant it too early.
No.
Those small...
Actually, Optimum germinates pretty well
okay?
in cooler, wet soils. Some of the older super sweets like Phenomenal and some of those, they don't germinate well in cold soils. You have to wait. You have to wait till the end of May to plant it. I still wait till the 1st of June to plant mine. But it's coming on the 1st of August. I mean, it comes on really quick when the soil's warm. So it's an 85-day corn. We planted it about the 1st of June. It's almost always ready the first week of August. So it just comes on a little bit faster. But Ambrosia, Sugar Buns are still just tough to beat. They're so good. And Incredible and Miracle are great for later varieties, but I'm just almost Optimum, strictly Optimum.
Do people grow Silver Queen anymore?
Silver Queen's kind of been replaced by, let's see, I've got Frosty and Argent. Argent's kind of improved.
So this is a white ear, Silver Queen, and it was just way tall.
Tall.
Like 10 feet
tall.
Yeah,
really tall. Frosty's really tall, but it's much earlier than the Silver Queen, but good size ears. Argent would be a really good replacement for it. And Silver Queen was developed up in southern Idaho and Caldwell, and the growers don't do that one anymore. They've kind of improved on some of the varieties. So great thing about all these varieties of corn, and I get lots of questions from people about genetically modified and GMOs and all this stuff. I mean, it's really a non-issue for home gardening. There are no genetically modified seeds for home gardening. They don't exist. Everything's commercial acreages, and a lot of these varieties that are out there, and there's probably only about 18 that are commercially usable right now. You can't buy them at the local seed store. They're just not available, and they probably won't ever be available because you have to sign your life away to get them. And so I've got people coming in and asking me almost daily, you know, do you have GMO seeds? It's like, I can't even buy them. I can't even get them. So it's like, Why are you asking me this? It's like, these are home garden varieties, just traditional breeding, traditional open pollinated, traditional hybrids. There's no genetic modification to them at all. Just good old fashioned plant pollinization.
Well, Mark, we'll have you back in again. There's still plenty to talk about.
Sounds great. There is. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming
in. Great time.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden was in the studio. Coming up next now is Nancy Williams with Petals and Prose.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, in for Petals and Prose. And today, I just am dying to share with you some readings from one of my favorite books. It's a classic children's book from the turn of the century. Lots of you may be familiar with it. I'm always surprised, though, to find the number of people who aren't. And of course, since it was written at the turn of the century by a Scottish gentleman, it's beautifully written and has a place in the hearts of adults as well as children. And he writes about some animals. Let me tell you a little bit about it. Wind in the Willows was written by Kenneth Graham, who was born in Scotland in 1859. From the age of 5, he lived with his grandmother in the Berkshire, where he spent a lot of time on the banks of the River Thames. Wind in the Willows grew from a series of stories he wrote for his young son. And since its publication in 1908, Kenneth Graham's book has enchanted readers young and old. Readers here will meet the amiable mole, his hearty friend the water rat, the genial badger, and of course the irrepressible Mr. Toad, and enjoy some of the most memorable adventures in children's literature. I want to read to you today from Chapter 4, which is just entitled Mr. Badger, and it's winter stories. All of his stories about these animals on the river are indexed pretty much according to seasons also. They wait patiently for what seemed a very long time, stamping in the snow to keep their feet warm. At last they heard the sound of slow, shuffling footsteps approaching the door from the inside. It seemed, as the mole remarked to the rat, like someone walking in carpet slippers that were too large for him and down at the heel, which was intelligent of mole because that was exactly what it was. There was the noise of a bolt shot back, and the door opened a few inches to show a long snout and a pair of sleepy eyes. "Now, the very next time this happens," said a gruff and suspicious voice, "I shall be exceedingly angry. Who is it this time disturbing people on such a night? Speak up!" "Oh, Badger," cried the rat, "let us in, please. It's me, Rat, and my friend Mole, and we've lost our way in the snow." "Ratty!" exclaimed the badger in quite a different voice. "Come along in, both of you. Why, you must be perished." "Well, I never. Lost in the snow, and in the wild wood, too, at this time of night." The two animals tumbled over each other in their eagerness to get inside and heard the door shut behind them with great joy and relief. The badger, who wore a long dressing gown and whose slippers were indeed very down at the heel, carried a flat candlestick and had probably been on his way to bed when their summons sounded. "This is not the sort of night for small animals to be out," he said. "I'm afraid you've been up to some of your pranks again, Ratty." He shuffled on in front of them, carrying the light, and they followed him down a long, and to tell the truth, decidedly shabby passage, into a sort of a hall out of which they could see other passages branching mysteriously. There were doors as well, stout oaken doors. One of these the badger flung open, and they found themselves in all the glow and warmth of a large firelit kitchen. The kindly badger thrust them down onto a settle to toast themselves at the fire, and bade them remove their wet coats and boots. And then he fetched them dressing gowns and slippers, and he bathed the mole's hurt shin with warm water, and he mended the cut with a sticking plaster till the whole thing was as good as new, if not better. Warm and dry at last, with weary legs propped up in front of them, it seemed to the storm-driven animals that the cold and trackless wildwood just left outside was miles and miles away, and all they had suffered in it was a half-forgotten dream. When at last they were thoroughly toasted, the badger summoned them to the table. They had felt pretty hungry before, but when they saw the supper spread for them, it seemed only a question of what they should attack first, where all was so attractive, and whether the other things would wait till they had time to give them attention. Conversation was impossible for a long time, and when it was resumed, it was that regrettable sort that results from talking with your mouth full. The badger did not mind that sort of thing at all, nor did he take any notice of elbows on the table or everybody speaking at once. As the animals told their story, he did not seem surprised or shocked at anything. He never said, "I told you so," or "just what I always said," or remarked that they ought to have done so-and-so, or ought not to have done something else. The mole began to feel very friendly towards him. Supper finished, they gathered round the glowing embers of the great fire and thought how jolly it was to be sitting up so late and so full. And after they had chatted for a time, the badger said, "Well, it's time we were all in bed." He conducted the two animals to a long room that seemed half bedchamber and half loft. The badger's winter food stores took up half the room, but the two little beds on the remainder of the floor looked soft and inviting, and the linen on them, though coarse, was clean and smelt beautifully of lavender. And the mole and the water rat, shaking off their garments in some 30 seconds, tumbled in between the sheets in great joy and contentment. The two tired animals came down to breakfast very late next morning and found a bright fire burning in the kitchen and two young hedgehogs sitting on a bench at the table eating oatmeal porridge out of wooden bowls. The hedgehogs dropped their spoons and rose to their feet respectively as the two entered. Sit down," said the rat pleasantly, "and go on with your porridge. Where have you youngsters come from? Lost your way in the snow, I suppose?" "Yes, please, sir," said the elder of the two hedgehogs. "Me and Billy was trying to find our way to school, and we lost ourselves, sir, and Billy got frightened and took and cried, being young, and we happened up against Mr. Badger's back door and knocked, sir, for Mr. Badger, he's a kind-hearted gentleman, as everyone knows." "I understand," said the rat, cutting himself some rashers of bacon, while the mole dropped some eggs into a saucepan. "And what's the weather like outside? You needn't sir me quite so much," he added. "Oh, terrible bad, sir. Terrible bad the snow is," said the hedgehog. "No getting out for you gentlemen today." "Where's Mr. Badger?" inquired the mole. "The master's gone into his study, sir," replied the hedgehog, "and said as how he was going to be particular busy this morning, and on no account was he to be disturbed." The animals well knew that Badger, having eaten a hearty breakfast, had retired to his study and settled himself in an armchair with his legs on another one and a red cotton handkerchief over his face, and he was being busy in the usual way at this time of the year. And that is the way children were introduced to this magical world of the underground lives of the badger and the mole and the rat in the woods along the River Thames. There's more of this wonderful thing. I could read it forever, but it's way too long to read in one little episode of Petals and Prose, so all I can do is give you that much, maybe intrigue you to find it, find a copy and read it again. Happy winter to you all. I'll see you next time. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.